Our show is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, Ina's official podcast from Food Network, back for its fourth season. On every episode, Ina invites a different friend to her home in the Hamptons to talk about life, love, and career, all while cooking up an amazing meal. Join Ina as she crafts a classic cocktail with journalist Frank Bruni and discusses the ins and outs of Yorkshire pudding with actress Emily Mortimer. If you're looking for great conversations about and over good food, tune in to Be My Guest with Ina Garten. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts.
It's The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this week we're asking the question, how do the insiders eat a bowl of ramen?
I'm sort of on this weird quest to get people to understand the art of the slurp, which is my new little tagline. I call it the art of the slurp. You make a nice O shape with your mouth. You don't want to purse your lips against the noodles. You want the sound of air just whipping through your face. And you want to inhale those noodles to the point where if you weren't inhaling, they would drop back into the bowl. That's when you know you're doing it right.
Stay with us for Ramen Master Ivan Orkin with the soup's 9 indispensable components, pretty different from that cup of noodles, and the latest twist in Mexican food. It's all here and much more this hour on The Splendid Table. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Put away everything you may think about ramen. Forget the plastic cup. Forget the block of noodles. Forget that pesky spice package. And forget the boiling water. Imagine instead a soup assembled before your eyes, just for you. Fresh noodles, steaming broth, a soup assembled with 9 exacting components, each one prepared separately over hours. That's what ramen is about. Ivan Orkin fell in love with Japan. He studied the language, traveled back and forth for years, became a chef, and then decided to become a student of ramen, and was gutsy enough to open a ramen shop in Tokyo, no less. Well, that story and that ramen recipe are in his book, Ivan Ramen, Love, Obsession, and Recipes from Tokyo's Most Unlikely Noodle Joint. Ivan, it's good to have you with us.
Oh, it's fabulous to be here.
So, Ivan, what is ramen to you?
Well, ramen, you know, it's funny because ramen, you would think it's just, you know, soup noodles. And I wouldn't blame someone for thinking that. And yet it's really anything but. It's a dish that's completely composed and balanced and harmonious. And for it to really work, the soup needs to marry with the noodles so that when you eat that bowl of noodles, everything sort of comes together in your mouth when you slurp it up, which is very different than the way you would eat a bowl of chicken noodle soup.
9 components to make a bowl of ramen.
Mm-hmm.
What are those components? Can you briefly give us a sort of lineup of them?
Well, of course, we'll just start with the simple part, right? You start with soup and noodles.
Right.
But that wouldn't have that umami excitement that all the hullabaloo is about. So when you have your bowl of ramen, you also add things like a flavor base. In Japanese, it's called a tare, a T-A-R-E. And it could be based on salt, on soy sauce, on miso, on a lot of different flavors. But you add that to your bowl, and then in addition, you add melted fat, which could be pork fat, beef fat, chicken fat, depending on, you know, what flavor
right.
you're trying to create. And and then you could sprinkle in other things. In one of my dishes, I sprinkle in powdered smoked fish. And then you pour a very hot soup on top of all of that. You add noodles into that, and then toppings. At Ivan Ramen, we really simple. We just put a piece of pork belly and a little thing of scallions on top. You can add on, like, you know, which makes it sort of that great sort of casual fast food item. You know,
right.
You can add eggs. You can add roasted tomatoes. You could add more meat. You can add garlic, chili oil. And you can make it this crazy, you know, stuff with lots of things in it as well. So it can get dressed up or it can be dressed down.
But it sounds like there's this ballet going on, a balance going on between those nine components, and you wouldn't want to mess it up.
Right.
I mean, I'm looking at the list in front of me. One of them is sofrito that you do with apples, onions, ginger, and garlic, and you cook that in oil for hours?
Hours and hours and hours.
And a little bit of that goes into the broth?
Well, you know, it's funny. I mean, I never worked in a ramen shop. When I decided to do this, I was living in Tokyo. I really wanted to – I didn't want to have a boss anymore. I wanted to have my own business, and a restaurant made a lot of sense. And at the time, I was just completely obsessed with ramen. And I decided to open a shop. But I was also 40 years old or 43 years old, and I didn't really want to have an apprenticeship. The ramen shop owners are very reluctant to tell you anything, and I didn't think anyone would teach me anything in a month.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't prepared to commit a year or two to an apprenticeship. So I just said, you know what, I'm going to figure this out myself. And I did a lot of reading, and obviously I'd already been cooking professionally for many years. And, you know, using a sofrito to me is one of the great secrets to adding depth of flavor to many, many different types of food and used in many cuisines. And it's a wonderful palate that you can add other flavors to. And so I have this very aromatic, deeply long-cooked flavor base that I then add salt to, or I add soy sauce to, or in other recipes I add chili peppers to it, or sesame.
Mm-hmm.
And it really just, you get these layers and layers and layers of flavor, so that I start with really delicious chicken soup. It's just whole chickens and water, and then not such a simple dashi, but a nice dashi that's very smoky and earthy.
Why don't you explain what dashi is? Because a lot of
that's a great point. You know, dashi is really the building block of Japanese cuisine. And really, most dashis in Japanese cuisine are really just kombu, which is a certain type of seaweed, and katsuobushi, which is a bonito, which is sort of dried and steamed and dried and smoked and shaved.
And that's fish flakes, essentially.
And essentially that's fish flakes. I take it to another couple levels by using a whole variety of that to make a more complex dashi. But in Japanese cuisine, those two ingredients are the main ones, and they're used that to sort of paint all kinds of flavors with.
So you've got two kinds of broth that you put in.
Two kinds of broth, where in Japan it's called a double soup. And believe it or not, they usually use the American letter W to say double.
That's interesting.
Yes, and my ramen style is a very small sort of niche market of, you know, the most popular style is the tonkotsu, which ton means pork, kotsu means bone, so the pork bone soup. It's very milky and rich, and I like it very much, but I tend to like to cook a lighter style. And as a chef, I love sending people home to feel good for many hours after they eat my food. And I found when I was doing all my research, eating so many bowls of ramen, you know, the ones on the heavier side would stay with me. And, you know, I wouldn't be able to eat another morsel of food for 10 or 12 hours,
mm-hmm.
which is great if you're a college kid, but I'm not. and I was like, I don't really want to make this. And I don't really want to feed people this style. And while I still like that style, and every once in a while I still eat it, mine is a much brighter, lighter version.
Now, Americans have a different sensibility about soups than I understand the Japanese do. How should I eat ramen?
That's a great question, and I'm sort of on this weird quest to get people to understand the art of the slurp, which is my new little tagline. I call it the art of the slurp. Because ramen really should be eaten when it's at its freshest, at its hottest. And the longer it sits, it starts to suck up the soup into the noodles, because obviously, you know, the noodles are made of flour and they're a sponge, and they're just going to change what it is I originally made for you.
And you know, a lot of people just don't taste noodles. They realize they have great flavor. Ivan, this has been, as we say, a revelation.
Oh, well, thank you.
Hey, thank you, and good luck with the ramen shop in New York.
Thank you so much, and if you ever make it our way, be sure to come and we can slurp together.
Ivan Orkin is the author of Ivan Ramen, Love, Obsession, and Recipes from Tokyo's Most Unlikely Noodle Joint. And he has Ivan Ramen Slurp Shop in New York City. Well, he left us with the recipe for omoraizu. Now, this is a rice omelet that takes that unusual sofrito he talked about and turns it into a fabulous risotto-like dish. Well, you can find the recipe at splendidtable.org. From diners to clam shacks, supper clubs to local VFWs, if there's a good home-style meal to be had, Jane and Michael Stern are going to be hot on its tracks. They're the minds behind roadfood.com. Jane, Michael, welcome back, guys.
Good to be here.
Hi, Lynn.
So, you know, I was thinking about this. Great desserts. What are some of the finds?
I'll tell you, one of the great desserts is one of the simplest. It's hot milk cake. It's a Southern classic. You don't find it too much anywhere, even in the South, where it is a traditional thing. If you haven't had it, hot milk cake is very much like pound cake. Maybe not quite as rich, very moist, very dense, and very simple. I mean, simple as in simple and perfect.
And happily, Michael and I found probably the only restaurant that I know about that serves hot milk cake on the daily menu. It's a place called Dr. Ho, H-O-apostrophe-S, Humble Pie, and it's 20 minutes east of Rockfish Gap in North Garden, Virginia. So that those directions should be very clear, Lynn. Right?
I can just picture exactly
yeah,
where it is.
20 minutes east of Rockfish Gap.
And I have to tell you how we got there. It wasn't for the excellent hot milk cake. It was because we were up at Turner's Ham House in Folks Run, Virginia, one of the great ham houses in the country. And they said, you know, if you want to try something really interesting made with our ham, go to Dr. Ho's Humble Pie. And what they do is take this classic Virginia ham and put it on a pizza in the same way prosciutto might be put on a pizza.
Ah.
And wow, what a great combination that is.
I would imagine. I mean, a really great piece of Virginia ham. Maybe it isn't Italian, but the same spirit.
It's shaved.
Shaved very thin, and it goes so well with you know, and with they actually add a little bit of sort of lemony, glistening arugula to the top of it. So, you know, it's not going to please the absolute pizza classicist, Lynn, but it's really very good.
Yeah, and you know what? As good as it was, as the pizza was, and it's very, very good, we just ate it really fast so we would have room for the hot milk cake, which to me is the star, not only the star of the show, but an incredible find because I can't think of any place where you can get hot milk cake.
But is it hot in that it's served warm or is it nope. that hot milk is part of the recipe?
Hot milk is part of the recipe. It's really like a pound cake.
But instead of using whipping cream, you use hot milk.
It gives it
a different texture. And at Dr. Ho's, it is just frosted a little bit with some beautiful, simple buttercream frosting.
Now, all right, so Dr. Ho's Humble Pie sounds like it's a pizza place.
It is.
Well, it's pizza and other things. I remember we had a great arugula and roasted sweet potato salad there, too. It's kind of Southern pizza, modern. It's a new place, but it's designed to look like an old garage.
They have really good grits.
Very
also,
good, yes.
Grits and greens is one of their specialties.
The crisp fried grit cakes and greens.
And butternut squash pizza. And, you know, Michael and I, well, you know, I mean, my God, Lynn, you've known us forever. We live in Connecticut, and therefore we have the best pizza in not only the United States, but the world. And for us to give the nod.
I hope you haven't mentioned this in Naples.
We did. It's probably why our passports were taken. But for us to rave about a pizza place that's near Rockfish Gap in Virginia, it's got to be pretty good. And this was really good.
So you can get the Old South and you can get the new pizza. This is not a bad combination.
The new pizza has Old South on it.
Well, when you're talking about local, this makes sense.
It does.
Absolutely. Just save room for hot milk cake.
Okay, I will. Hey, thanks, guys.
Bye.
Bye, Larry.
Jane and Michael Stern are the authors of the classic eating out guide, Road Food, which has just been updated. Now you can check out their picks on the website, splendidtable.org. Coming up, the American food trending hot in Mexico and the real deal behind those beady green nubs called capers. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You want to taste some fascinating and telling things that can happen to a dish? Well, track how it changes as it crosses borders. Whether it's because we immigrants bring it with us or the webs launched it into kitchens around the planet. Gustavo Orellano knows a lot about this. He writes the syndicated column Ask a Mexican, where he takes a real-life look at how cultures interlace. He's also written Taco USA, How Mexican Food Conquered the USA. Our contributor, Patty Hinnich, checks in on the state of Mexican food in the United States.
Hola, Gustavo.
Hola, ¿qué tal?
Gustavo, tell me, what's going on with Mexican food on the West Coast?
Right now, what's going on with Mexican food is really two trends. You're seeing the rise of what I still call regional Mexican cuisine. In other words, la comida of states that historically didn't have a immigrant population to the United States, but in the past 20 years, they really have. So now in Southern California, it's almost as common to be eating a tlayuda, which is a big, huge Oaxacan tortilla filled with quesillo and, a black bean paste, as it is burritos or tacos. Mm-hmm. Then on the other hand, you have the continued, some people call it mongrelization. I call it the evolution, the multiculturalism of Mexican food, as best exemplified, of course, by Korean tacos through the Koji Korean barbecue truck.
Fabulous, because I was just going to ask you, are there any new hybrids popping up on your screen?
Well, you're always going to have hybrids depending on what part of the United States you live. So, for instance, in Louisiana, they're already selling alligator tacos and alligator tamales. And this has actually been going back like 15 to 20 years, even though historically Louisiana didn't have a significant Latino Mexican population. What's interesting to me, at least, as someone who was born and raised in Southern California, is you've always had this multiculturalism lurking in the background, even though no one ever wanted to talk about it, really. My favorite Mexican multicultural meal in Southern California are teriyaki bowls. Here in Southern California, the teriyaki has turned into an almost exclusively Mexican treat, especially in Orange County. There's a famous chain called Moss, M-O-S-2, so Moss 2. And what you'll have is your regular teriyaki bowl, so you have your beef, chicken, or pork, but it's cut really thin, like a carne asada, especially the beef. You know, Mexicans, we love our beef very, very thinly cut. Yeah. The white rice is the same, and the teriyaki sauce is the same. But instead of scallions, you have cebollitas, little green onions, and then the other condiment, instead of sriracha, is tapatio hot sauce, a Mexican hot sauce that goes with teriyaki. And you always wash it down with an horchata, because horchata, of course, rice water drink, it accentuates the sweetness of the beef and the teriyaki. So it's like the typical working class meal here in Orange County.
Right. So we're turning that bowl into a taco bowl without the tortilla or with the tortilla?
No tortilla. You just eat it like a straightforward bowl. And it's gotten so popular now that, of course, you think of a teriyaki bowl as being a Japanese meal, but almost the only people who eat these teriyaki bowls are not Japanese or even Asians at all. It's working class white folks and Mexicanos.
And now tell me a little bit about the fish tacos and all the California style tacos. I think it starts to get a little bit confusing, or the lines blur, when you think about Baja cuisine, from Baja California. Do you think California and Baja California have some dishes evolving at the same time?
The best example of sort of the collusion between CalMex cuisine and then Baja California cuisine, the most famous example, of course, is the fish taco, although it came into the United States via Baja, your tortilla, your fried fish, or maybe grilled fish, and that's that. But the big thing is tostilocos. Tostilocos, of course, you know what it is. You want some right now, don't
we all? But I want you to describe them.
Yeah, so tostiloco is essentially you get a bag of Tostitos chips, or it could be Fritos or Doritos, and then you, instead of just opening it and putting tapatio or hot sauce on it, you doctor them. You put some chicharrones, you might put some corn nuts, you might put some pickled cebollas, pickled onions, you might put some rabanos, radishes. And then the other interesting thing, what I think makes the tostilocos, you put a chamoy sauce. And a chamoy sauce, you could probably describe it better. You're the cook.
the chamoy sauce is these, like, spicy, sweet, and sour sauce that has a little bit of tamarind sometimes, or apricot sometimes. And I used to eat that with the crunchy peanuts when I was growing up.
Oh, yeah. It's like the ultimate umami flavor. All it is jam-packed flavor, slightly sour, slightly sweet. And so you put it on these Tostilocos. And, of course, Tostitos, very American company. Yeah. But the Tostilocos was born in Tijuana specifically, one of the capitals of street food in the world. Mm-hmm. And it's been in Southern California now for about 10 years, and it's slowly starting to spread across the country. My good friend John T. Edge from the Southern Foodways Alliance a couple of years ago did an article in the New York Times about Tostilocos. And you know, the purists will say, oh, that's not real Mexican food. Pero es Mexicanos who are making this cuisine, and it's Mexicanos who are eating it.
Exactly. It's Mexican street food. Now, tell me, what about the American foods that Mexicans have embraced?
Mexico has always embraced foreign cuisine. The very definition of Mexican food is a multicultural cuisine. So the beers that all Americans love, your Dos Equis, your Tecate, your Negra Modelo, those were all German and Czech beers. I mean, you know, it's called Bohemia, not because an Aztec emperor was called Bohemia, you know? And even though we like to, you know, pretend that we don't like the United States and we're a purely Mexican nation, no, we've always embraced American food that's come our way. The best example, of course, Mexican Coca-Cola, Mexican Coke. American hipsters love Mexican Coke because it's still made with sugarcane.
Gustavo, it's just a fact. Mexican Coca-Cola is much better than American Coca-Cola.
I completely agree. But my personal favorite of food that Mexicanos have embraced are bacon-wrapped hot dogs. The hot dog, of course, quintessential American meal, bacon, an obsession of Americans. Mexicanos, we like it too, tocino, you know, a little bit. But, you know, somewhere in the 1950s, at least according to legend, the bacon-wrapped hot dog was born in the Mexican state of Sonora. And in the 80s and 90s, it went up to Arizona, to the Tucson region, then bounced back to Tijuana. And for the past 10 to 15 years, it has been going up north on Interstate 5 and east on Interstate 10, slowly conquering the United States.
I'll just sit here and wait for them to come to Washington, D.C. Gustavo, one last question. Is there a food that you are surprised that Mexicans have abandoned, or a food that you have been shocked that hasn't been extremely popular in the U.S.?
I'm absolutely shocked that America has yet to embrace the torta as the next big cult food.
I completely agree. That crispy, crunchy, incredibly delicious sandwich, it's like the perfect edible package.
They've been in the United States now for a good 20 to 30 years. I think the torta is going to be the next big trend. Already celebrity chefs are hawking their tortas at their restaurants. But, I mean, that's, I think, 15 years too late. And it's so good. My God, I need a torta right now, actually.
I agree. Gustavo, the next time we meet, it will have to be over la torta.
Yeah, I would love that.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Gracias for having me.
Gustavo Orellano is the author of Taco USA, How Mexican Food Conquered America. Patty Himich is author of Patty's Mexican Table. Patty left us with another version of those delicious Mexican sandwiches, the pambazo. Imagine crusty bread soaked in a guajillo chili sauce and then stuffed with potatoes and chorizo. Forget the torta. Well, the recipe's at splendidtable.org. There are a handful of ingredients that can really add life to a dish. You know, lemon, vinegar, anchovies, olives, and capers. Nearly every grocery store has them, but does it matter if they're big or small, in vinegar or dried and salted? And is there a caper nirvana where the very best are found? Well, to shed some light on these pertinent questions, Sally Swift turned to the man of the golden palate, David Rosengarten of davidrosengarten.com.
Hey, David, nice to have you with us.
Nice to be here.
So I want to talk about capers today. Can you tell us what they are?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a great question because I think people use them all the time, but what they are exactly, not so well known. So there's a plant that's called the Capparis spinosa. And when the plant creates a bud, and this starts every year in the spring, this bud is going to be a flower. However, if you pick the bud before it becomes a flower, that's a caper. And in fact, properly, we should call it a caper bud, because the whole plant is a caper plant, and it has various parts. But what we all call a caper is a caper bud.
And then what about those bigger things that we see called caper berries?
As it goes through its cycle, the plant, if you leave the bud on the plant, then a couple weeks later, it opens up as a flower, as a beautiful purple and white flower. And then, if you let the flower fall off, You know, this is something that happens in nature all the time. All fruits, the flower falls off, and it's replaced a little bit later in the season by a fruit. And that fruit is called the caper berry. And it's kind of like, it looks sort of like an olive. You know, it's oblong. It's much bigger than a caper bud.
Mm-hmm.
And it has a very similar kind of taste, and it's treated a similar way. Probably is not quite as intense tasting as the caper bud, but it has a very similar flavor, and it's really quite delicious. By the way, Sally, in Greece, they also like to use the leaves of the caper plant.
Wow, what an amazing plant to get all
of the leaves.
It's pretty great. And so where are the best capers grown?
Well, there are capers grown all over the Mediterranean, and some are grown in Asia and in Australia. However, most people in the world of capers will tell you that the very best capers come from a small island called Pantelleria that is off the coast of Sicily. So it's really part of Sicily.
Mm-hmm.
And in actuality, geographically, it's between Sicily and Africa.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually a little bit closer to Tunisia than it is to the main part of the Sicilian island. But that's it. That is caper heaven. And yeah, happily, they're widely available. So if you go to a good, you know, gourmet grocery store, you'll find capers from Pantelleria.
And are they farmed there or are they wild?
Yeah, you can cultivate it. And I saw a caper farm where everything had been planted. But I also saw the caper bush growing wild all over the island.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Okay, now the big question, because we can find them cured in those little bottles, you know,
yes,
in little vinegar, and then salted in. What's the difference?
Yes. Well, in order for, you know, sort of like olives, if you tasted an olive without any curing, it's horrible. It's bitter. It's sort of the same for the caper. There needs to be some kind of cure before you can really enjoy it, and that involves salt. And there's several ways you can do it. You can mix the caper buds just with, you know, good coarse salt, or you can mix it with salt and water, making a brine,
mm-hmm,
or you can mix it with salt and vinegar, or salt and water and vinegar. But basically, you got it right. There's the two ways to go, the liquid way or the dry way with the salt. Now,
what's your preference?
Yeah, definitely the dry way. In Pantelleria, all the good places make it dried just with the salt. It's trickier. It's more expensive because, you know, I went into some storage rooms where they had big bushels of capers sitting there with the salt, and they have to go in there every day and mix them up because they have to make sure that the salt is evenly distributed. But if you put them in a big, you know, barrel with liquid, then you don't have to worry about that. It's just kind of easier and faster. But I think they end up tasting a little more washed out. Not a lot. They taste like capers,
mm-hmm,
but I think the intensity of the salt cured is much better.
Mm-hmm. And what about sizes? Should we be going for the smaller ones or the bigger ones?
Well, I did a little research on the internet just to see what people are saying, and as I expected, almost everybody says, get the smaller ones. They're better. But that is one of those food myths,
mm-hmm,
that just won't go away. The only reason that you hear it is because that's what everybody has always said, and nobody, you know, has really taken the trouble to research it, I think.
Mm-hmm.
When I was there in Pantelleria, I kept asking, what size do I want? And everybody I spoke to, from producers to chefs to local food writers, they all said, oh, the big ones are much more flavorful.
That's...
So they usually come in three sizes, small, medium, and large. The downside about the larger ones is, imagine what we were talking about before. These are closer to springing open and becoming flowers.
Mm-hmm.
So they're not quite as tight in texture. They're not quite as firm. They have, like, you know, a flower inside them waiting to break out. However, they have developed to the most gorgeous flavor.
I love the idea of a flower being ready to burst out of those bigger
exactly
ones. It's very
yes
romantic. Okay, last but not least, how do they use them on that island?
Ubiquitously. Almost
for every breakfast?
Yeah, I didn't see that, no. But almost every dish you get served, you know, their caponata definitely has a lot of capers in it, sauces, sprinkled in salads, all that kind of thing. But they do make something quite special there. They're off the west coast of the main island of Sicily, and on the west coast is a place called Trapani. And in Trapani, they make a pesto, or local form of pesto. They call it pesto. It doesn't look like our pesto. Our pesto, of course, is always very basil-y and green. But theirs is quite red because they make it with tomatoes. And they also pound almonds into it, and they add, of course, capers to it.
Sounds delicious. David, thank you very much.
Pleasure, Sally. Thank you.
David Rosengarten's work can be found at davidrosengarten.com. Sally Swift is our managing producer. So take a look at David's recipe for caponata.
It's at splendidtable.org. James Osland is a big fan of both food and travel, which is a good thing because he's editor-in-chief of Savour magazine and a judge on Top Chef Masters. But even before all this, he'd written the award-winning book Cradle of Flavor, chronicling his time in Southeast Asia. Well, now, in his spare time, he's put together A Fork in the Road, travel stories from our best-known food folk. Noelle Carter gets the story.
James, I'm so excited to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Oh, I'm so excited to be here.
Well, you know, it's funny because the collection is sort of a compilation of everything from exotic travel stories to people sitting around the table and watching their mother cook. But what was the foundation for the book and kind of what was the core idea that you were going for?
Well, the core idea, the directive that I'd given the contributors was to tell a story that involved in some way food or eating or the preparation of food or even the procuring of food, shopping for food in a market, that in one way or another had a meaningful impact on their lives.
Were there any experiences, any stories that surprised you?
I'll tell you one of my absolute favorite stories actually opens the book. It's the wonderful British writer and TV presenter Giles Corran. He wrote a piece about being a kid growing up in London and traveling for the first time to America. He's actually in Florida on this very first trip and eating McDonald's for the first time. And to this kid growing up in London, this was this extraordinary epiphany of taste. What he's ultimately writing about in the piece, though, is not that McDonald's meal, but instead his desire to have a Twinkie, which he didn't have on that particular trip. And he didn't, in fact, actually taste a Twinkie until about two decades later. And he was a little disappointed in how the Twinkie tasted, which I guess I can understand, but I'm sort of a Twinkie lover, so I can't completely support him in that regard. But I love that story of yearning for the exotic and the unknown, even if the unknown is McDonald's.
It was really sad when he finally ate the Twinkie at the end and he didn't really like it.
And then on the other hand, you've got this beautiful contribution from the novelist Sigrid Nunez, who usually writes about Susan Sontag and lofty topics. But instead, she's contributing a really gorgeous, very quiet, small piece to this book, writing about a first trip to Paris. And Paris was very crowded and it was a really difficult trip. And she was in her early 20s and, oh, it was just hard. And you think of Paris as being, you know, this city of three-star Michelin restaurants and all of that gorgeousness and exoticness. But the thing that she ate that transformed her life, she was just so hungry and so tired, was a piece of coconut that was sold by a street vendor that her husband brought to her. And it just provided such sustenance. And suddenly she was relaxed and she was able to appreciate Paris. And so I just love the unpredictability of these food stories that we all have up our sleeve.
One of the ones that really kind of took me aback was when one of the writers talks about going to Italy. And he starts with the soup and the kids are all clamoring around the pot. They're very excited to have it. And he finds out later that what he was eating was a blood soup. And then the story goes on, and he tries this famous Italian cheese with live maggots in it, and just the experiences of that, and how it's maybe revolting to him, and yet to the local kids, it's a delicacy, and they're so excited to have it.
You know, I think that the story you're referring to, I've titled the story They Eat Maggots, Don't They?, which is kind of racy, funny titles for a very racy, funny story by the really terrific British novelist Joe Dunthorne. On the one hand, there's a kind of like ew factor to it, like definitely fear factor, or like, oh my gosh, that's insects and it's weird and it's bizarre food. But on the other hand, you know, I can think of an experience I had myself in Northeast Thailand where this is going to sound strange, but insects are like a part of what people eat in their everyday diet. It's very poor there. It's very dry there. But when you're sitting down at, you know, a village table with the family feeding you food that they've harvested just that morning and it okay, so it happens to be ant eggs and queen ants, and you're eating a salad of queen ants. Oh my gosh, I can't believe I'm actually eating this. But it's actually a really delicious and very, very beautiful thing. And for these people, it's no stranger than, you know, the meal I ate last night in New York City that was very exotic and, you know, wonderful. But for them, it would just be kind of unthinkably strange. There's something for me so glorious about the connectivity of what we eat, the great joy in the commonality we share in food.
Well, James, thank you so much for your time, and I can't wait to read a volume two.
Oh, thank you so much.
James Oseland is the editor of A Fork in the Road. Noelle Carter is the Los Angeles Times Test Kitchen director and writes the Culinary SOS column. The wondrous Indian scholar Madhur Jaffrey is included in that collection, so we thought it time to give one of her recipes a test drive. Take a look at her delicious version of cilantro chicken. You know where it is, splendidtable.org. Now we're going to be back in a minute to talk to you and look at ancient nonstick. And I'm not talking the 1970s here. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. It is time to connect with you. You can find us at 800-537-5252. Check us out on Facebook and Twitter, or shoot us an email. Go to splendidtable.org. We have Bridget on the line from Austin, Texas. Bridget, what's on your mind?
Well, I live in a 1906 house, and there are these overgrown shrubs. And one of them, I don't know whether it's a shrub or a tree, is a loquat. And it's just filled with all this abundant fruit. And I looked in a cookbook that I had, and I couldn't find anything to do with loquats, and I was curious if you have some ideas what you can do with loquats.
Let's review. What's a loquat?
At first, I thought they were kumquats, but a loquat is about a little smaller than the size of an apricot.
Right.
And I've been eating them, and they're sort of tart, but they're more of an orangey-yellow color rather than quite as orange as an apricot. So they have a sort of tartness to them.
And they have a black seed, don't they?
Yes, they're actually, yeah. Some of them have three black seeds, or the seed seeds to be joined together. And
they're crisp. They're a little bit like a peach in texture, right?
And yes.
With a slightly unripe peach, yeah. I know loquats really well because I used to drive around southern Italy with a bag of them on the car seat.
Oh.
Sloughing off a little bit of, as I remember, they have a bit of a skin, and sloughing it off and just slurping them. And I don't want to tell you what I did with the pits, but I think the highways I traveled now have a lot of loquat trees growing on them. First of all, I think they beg to be served. Just, you know, slice them in half, get rid of the seeds, make a little bit of something like a ginger chili syrup, you know, equal parts of sugar and water. Add some cut up or minced up fresh ginger. And you're in Austin. You've got the best chilies in the world right there. Throw a whole chili in there. Cook that until the sugar's melted.
All right.
Let it steep. Pull out the chili. You want a little sparkle. You don't want to kill yourself with heat, but you want a little sparkle. And then you strain. Mm-hmm. And you can keep that in the fridge for, a month more.
Wow.
And wouldn't it be great to arrange them on a plate or cut them into wedges so they look like, you know, little crescent moons?
And
just drizzle them with that syrup.
I'm salivating right now just thinking about it.
Yeah, and you know, the other thing that would be great, because I would toss them with a bit of sugar, okay, and a little pinch of salt, and then you could do an open-faced tart, and you could do whipped up ricotta that you puree with mascarpone and sugar and vanilla to taste. In a food processor, spread that on the bottom, and then top it with the fresh loquat that's been lightly sweetened.
Uh-huh.
Would be pretty swell, too.
That would be. Well, thank you so much.
You are welcome.
Inspired.
And I should go back to Austin and come back with a bag full of loquats. I was there in the wrong season, obviously. Hey.
Well, they're amazing.
They really are. Bridget, thanks for a great question.
All right. Bye-bye.
Lauren is calling from Elk River, Minnesota. Lauren, what's on your mind? What do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. My question is about a dish at an Indian restaurant. It's a red chutney, an onion chutney, And I've looked online for it, for recipes. I've looked in Indian cookbooks, and I can't find the recipe. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Now, it's red onion that's being made into a chutney?
Mm-hmm.
And it's raw?
Yeah, I think they're raw or maybe kind of pickled.
Okay, and what do they taste like?
Well, they're not sharp.
Yeah.
And they're not super sweet, but it goes really well with papadums. And, you know, it's kind of like...
Oh, come on. What doesn't go well with a papadum?
And true.
We should explain, by the way, the papadum is the Indian version of the potato chip. These are rounds, usually, what, about 4 or 5 inches, you think,
right.
Lauren? Yeah. Of lentil flour. They can be spiced in different ways. And you either roast them or you drop them in a little bit of oil. And I think they could put the potato chip out of business. But, okay,
yeah,
so,
they are better than potato chips.
Tell me, what else is in there? For instance, are there raisins? Are there little bits of chili, perhaps?
No raisins. Every time I go to an Indian restaurant, I ask for it. And most restaurants seem to have it.
Okay.
And then I've asked for the recipe and the...
They just don't have that recipe, huh? It's interesting.
Well, they won't share it.
Yeah, exactly.
Secret.
Okay, this is my guess. It's chopped red onion, right?
Right.
You're going to take that chopped red onion. You're going to lightly salt it, okay, to get rid of excess juice. And also, that gets rid of some of the fire of the onion, all right? And then...
Yeah, and maybe it has tomato in it?
It could. It could. Then you might want to dice up some tomato. And I'd use those grape tomatoes because they've got much better flavor when it's not tomato season. So dice those up as well. Give it a bit of fresh lime juice, pepper, okay? And did it have any sense of having cumin or coriander in it? Or was there anything green in it?
I didn't detect any of that.
Okay, now the tomato is going to mellow it. Now, the other thing you might want to add to that is a little bit of garlic that you've first soaked in the lime juice. And you're going to do this to taste. You're going to have the bowl of onions in front of you that you've shaken out of the towel. You're going to add the tomato. You're going to add the lime juice to taste. And then I'm thinking what might be interesting to do is to, I just had a scathingly brilliant idea. Why don't you roast the tomato before you put it in? Because that's going to mellow it and lightly sweeten it. And does it have a slightly sweet overtone to it?
Maybe a little, and it might even have some oil in it.
Ah, okay. All right. Take those tomatoes, put them on a griddle, or just put them on a piece of foil under the broiler, and just wait until they start to pucker a little bit, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Then squish them up. That goes with the onion, with the lime juice, and I would do just the smallest smidge of brown sugar, and then I think I would probably do a little bit of ground coriander, the coriander seed.
Yeah, okay.
Okay, and see if that comes close, and then you could add either a little bit of mustard oil, which you would get in an Indian shop, or you could add a little bit of, believe it or not, olive oil.
Mm-hmm.
Just a small amount.
Yeah.
And then see what you get.
Okay.
Okay.
Well, I'll definitely give it a try.
Give it a shot. I don't think you're going to dislike this.
No, I don't think I'm going to dislike it either. It's almost like a salsa.
Yes, and that's pretty common. And have you checked Raghavan Iyer's book, 660 Curries?
No, I haven't checked that one.
Raghavan is actually based in Minnesota, in Minneapolis. But his book, 660 Curries, first of all, it's a treasure. But secondly, you just might find something really close. Okay?
Yeah, I'm definitely going to try it. Thank
and do
you.
Me a favor, call us and let us know what's happening.
Okay.
Okay, thank you.
Sure. Bye-bye.
Call us, 800-537-5252. You know, if you're into the paleo diet, why not take on the appropriate cookware? This is a new find. Julie Ruby is assistant professor of classics at Dartmouth. She researches ancient craft production and the socioeconomic aspects of feasting. Well, this brought her to a very interesting culinary discovery. Cookware from 1700 years before Christ, but no ordinary pot. Professor Ruby, welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So this project, you're looking at cooking implements of 3,000 years ago. How did you get into this?
It was an accident. I went to write a dissertation at the University of Cincinnati, and I was asked to take a look at material from about five rooms from Mycenaean Palace, and they happened to be the pantries. So the material there was mostly serving wares, bowls and cups and wine glasses and that kind of thing, for a huge feast. There would have been enough to serve maybe 1,000 people. So the obvious question was what they were eating.
Maybe we need to do a where and when here. First of all, where exactly was this from? It's Mycenaean, but what does that actually mean, the period and the actual location?
The Mycenaean period runs about 1700 to about 1100 BC, so about 3,000 years ago. And where is roughly modern Greece and a chunk of Western Turkey.
And this was a palace that had been excavated?
Yes. It's a palace that was excavated starting in 1939, but mostly in the 1950s and 60s.
So you had these five rooms and they were feeding 1,000 people. This had to be mind-boggling.
It's a jaw-dropping amount of pottery, 3.5 metric tons approximately, stored in boxes in a Greek museum, and much of it had received very little attention.
That's so interesting. You would think that that would have been something to dig into almost immediately to figure out what day-to-day life was like in the palace.
Well, it's a big palace, and it had about 105 rooms. So the service quarters had actually received a lot less attention than the big ceremonial spaces. The other distraction, I shouldn't call it that, it was actually immensely helpful, is that the palace had archives in Linear B, which is the earliest recorded form of Greek. And there were over 1,000 tablets, clay tablets, that were preserved in the fire that led to the palace's destruction.
So this is really fascinating stuff. I'm thinking of that part of the world and things like fruits and olives and that sort of thing. Is there any proof of, you know, a diet that I almost think of as a biblical diet?
That's not too far off. Certainly grains would have been important, and barley and figs seem to have been staples. So the tablets tell us that the rations that are given to slaves are things like barley and figs. People would have eaten lots of beans, and we have remnants of chickpeas and lentils and so on, remains of lots of different kinds of grains, including barley and wheat and emmer and so on. People probably didn't eat meat on a daily basis. That would have been something you would have eaten for special. Beef or mutton or pork, goat. There's even some evidence for venison, that they were hunting deer. Wine, they certainly drank a lot of wine. The palace had several thousand gallons of wine in storage at the time it was destroyed.
Oh, my.
Bread would have been special. It all had to be ground by hand, and that would have been a lot of work. This is before animal-powered mills were in use. They'd have had fig syrup and honey for sweeteners. They certainly had cheese, and they had a few super special kinds of foods that would have been used only by very elite people under special circumstances. We know that they were importing pomegranates from the Near East. There were pomegranate seeds that showed up on a shipwreck where the ship was bound for the Mycenaeans. We have introductions of new species right about this time. Things like walnut trees start to come into cultivation. There are other foods like sesame. The word sesame is borrowed from the Near East, so sesame probably was special. But we actually have evidence for a pretty wide range of different herbs and spices, things like mint and coriander. Overall, I think if you were an elite Mycenaean, the food was probably pretty good.
It sounds like it. So, okay, you ran into something you had never seen before. What was it?
One of the types of things that I ran into was a series of different types of cooking pots that were a little idiosyncratic. Standard Mycenaean cooking takes place over a hearth, and mostly they just used various cooking jars and tripod cooking pots with little feet. But there were a couple of different kinds of cooking pots in the palace. One of them was called a souvlaki tray in the original publications. And it's a type that most of us, I think, agree was used for cooking meat on skewers. It's essentially a box with three sides, shallow box, and along the two long sides, there are little indentations along the top, and skewers would have been placed across those.
Mm-hmm.
The other was a griddle. These are really distinctive looking implements. They're big discs with perforations halfway through them and a wall around the outside. And the question was, which way goes up? They seem to have been used for baking bread, and Americans tend to publish them with the perforation side up, and the British and the Germans tend to publish them with perforation side down. And my suspicion was that they really needed to go perforation side up. The question was why. So one of my students made a couple of them, and we tried one perforation side up and one perforation side down, and we discovered that bread tended to stick more to the flat side than it did to the perforated side. So we used a good amount of olive oil on both, but we ended up with something a little closer to a nonstick surface when we used the perforation side up.
3,000 years ago, they were trying to get to Teflon. Julie, thanks so much for talking with us.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's been fun.
Julie Ruby is assistant professor of classics at Dartmouth. Now, we have our own ancient kebab recipe for you. Take a look at weeknight kofta with allspice and almonds. It's on the website, splendidtable.org. Well, that's it for today. Be sure to join us next week. And in the meantime, let me leave you with this thought from Julia Child, who said, "Always start out with a larger pot than you think you need." The Splendid Table is produced by APM, American Public Media. Now take a look at our website, splendidtable.org, to get information on anything you heard here today. Browse through our recipes, visit our online store, get registered for our podcasts and weekly e-newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen, and check out our e-books, Eating In with Lynn. It's all there for you at splendidtable.org. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Laura Kalibi. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Andy Cruz. Sally Swift is our managing producer. We're going to be back next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is APM, American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.